Hello, hello. Welcome back to another section of A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. Hope you are enjoying this one. If you are, let me know with the like button or in the comments. I certainly am enjoying it. All right, we are on page 123. I'm thinking let's get right into it. I've got kind of a lot of time today, oddly enough. So let's try to do kind of a long one. So, you know, get prepped, get some comfy clothes, a drink, a blanket, whatever you need to be comfy. All right, page 123. We are at the star in the middle of the page. If you're following along, we've got the little star mark. All right. The sound of the door clicking shut behind you. The Count wasn't sure he had ever heard it before, exactly. In tone, it was delicate and unobtrusive, and yet it had a definitive suggestion of dismissal, which was apt to put one in a philosophical frame of mind. Even if a person generally frowned upon rude and abrupt behavior, under these circumstances, he might have to admit a certain rough justice upon finding himself in an empty hallway with his shoes in his hand and his shirt untucked as the woman he's just left falls soundly asleep, for if a man has had the good fortune to be plucked from the crowd by an impetuous beauty, shouldn't he expect to be sent on his way without ceremony? Well, maybe so. But standing in the empty corridor across from a half-eaten bowl of borscht, the Count felt less like a philosopher than a ghost. Yes, a ghost, thought the Count as he moved silently down the hall, like Hamlet's father roaming the ramparts of Elsinore after the midnight watch, or like Akaki Akakievich, that forsaken spirit of Gogol's, who in the wee hours haunted the Kalinkin Bridge in search of his stolen coat. Why is it that so many ghosts prefer to travel the halls of night? Ask the living, and they will tell you that these spirits either have some unquenched desire for an unaddressed grievance that stirs them from their sleep and sends them out into the world in search of solace. But the living are so self-centered. Of course they would judge a spirit's nocturnal wanderings as the product of earthly memories, when in fact, if these restless souls wanted to herald the bustling adventures of noon, there is nothing to stop them from doing so. Now, if they wander the halls of night, it is not from grievance with or envy of the living. Rather, it is because they have no desire to see the living at all, any more than snakes hope to see gardeners or foxes, the hounds. They wander about at midnight because at that hour they can generally do so without being harried by the sound and fury of earthly emotions. After all those years of striving and struggling, and hoping and praying, of shouldering expectations, stomaching opinions, navigating decorum, and making conversation, what they seek, quite simply, is a little peace and quiet. At least, that is what the Count told himself as he drifted down the hall. Well, as a rule, the Count always took the stairs. When he approached the second floor landing that night, on some ghostly whim, he called for the elevator, assuming he would have it to himself. But when the doors slid open, there was the one-eyed cat. Kutuzov, he exclaimed in surprise, taking in every detail of the Count's appearance. The Count responded exactly as the Grand Duke had responded under similar circumstances many years before. That is, with a stern look and a disappointed silence. Said the Count as he stepped onto the elevator while trying to tuck in his shirt without dropping his shoes. Parting with the cat on the fifth floor, the Count trudged up the steps of the belfry in woeful acknowledgement that the celebration of his anniversary had been a fiasco. Having set out to gamely etch his mark on the wall, that wall had etched its mark on him. And as experience had taught the Count many years before, when this happens, it is best to wash one's face, brush one's teeth, and pull one's covers over one's head. But as the Count was about to open the door to his rooms, on the back of his neck he felt a breeze of air that was distinctly reminiscent of a summer breeze. Turning to his left, the Count stood motionless. There it was again, coming from the other end of the room. Intrigued, the Count walked down the hall, only to find that all the doors were tightly shut. At the hallway's end, there seemed to be nothing but a confusion of pipes and flues. But in the farthest corner, in the shadow of the largest pipe, he discovered a wall-mounted ladder that led to a hatch in the roof, which someone had left open. Putting on his shoes, the Count quietly climbed up the ladder and out into the night. The summer breeze that had beckoned the Count now wrapped him in its full embrace, warm and forgiving. It called upon feelings of summer, nights from earlier in his life, from when he was 5 and 10 and 20, on the streets of St. Petersburg, or the pastures of Eidelhauer. Nearly overcome by the surge of old sentiments, he needed to pause a moment before continuing to the western edge of the roof. Before him lay the ancient city of Moscow, which, after waiting patiently for 200 years, was once again the seat of Russian governance. Despite the hour, the Kremlin shimmered with electric light from every window as if its newest denizens were still too drunk with power to sleep. But if the lights of the Kremlin shimmered brightly, like all earthly lights before them, they were diminished in their beauty by the majesty of the constellations overhead. Craning his neck, the Count tried to identify the few that he had learned in his youth. Perseus, Orion, the Great Bear, each flawless and eternal. To what end, he wondered, had the divine created the stars in heaven to fill a man with feelings of inspiration one day and insignificance the next? Lowering his gaze to the horizon, the Count looked out beyond the limits of the city to where that ancient comfort of sailors, the morning star, burned brightest in all the firmament. And then blinked. "Good morning, Your Excellency." The Count spun about. Standing a few feet behind him was a man in his early 60s wearing a canvas cap. When the man took a step forward, the Count recognized him as one of the handymen who battled the hotel's leaky pipes and creaky doors. "That's the Shukov, all right," he said.
"The Shukov?"
"The radio tower." He pointed in the distance toward the comfort of sailors. "Ah," thought the Count with a smile, "Mishka's spiraling structure of steel broadcasting the latest news and intelligence." The two men were silent for a moment, as if waiting for the beacon to blink again, which it reliably did. "Well, the coffee will be ready. Might as well come along." The old handyman led the Count to the northeast corner of the roof, where he had established something of a camp between two chimneys. In addition to a three-legged stool, there was a small fire burning in a brazier, on which a coffee pot was steaming. The old man had chosen the spot well, for while it was out of the wind, he still had a view of the Bolshoi that was only slightly impaired by some old crates stacked at the edge of the roof. "I don't get many visitors," the handyman said, "so I don't have a second stool." "That's quite all right," said the Count, picking up a 2-foot plank, setting it on end, and balancing himself on its edge. "Can I pour you a cup?" "Thank you." As the coffee was being poured, the Count wondered whether this was the beginning or end of the old man's day. Either way, he figured a cup of coffee would hit the spot. For what is more versatile, as at home in tin as it is in Limoges, coffee can energize the industrious at dawn, calm the reflective at noon, or raise the spirits of the beleaguered in the middle of the night. "It's perfect," said the Count. The old man leaned forward. "The secret is in the grinding." He pointed to a little wooden apparatus with an iron crank. "Not a minute before you brew." The Count raised his eyebrows with the appreciation of the uninitiated. Yes, in the open air on a summer night, the old man's coffee was perfect. In fact, the only thing that spoiled the moment was a humming in the air, the sort that might be emitted from a faulty fuse or a radio receiver. "Is that the tower?" the Count asked.
"Is what the tower?"
"The humming." The old man looked up in the air for a moment, then cackled.
"That'll be the boys at work."
"The boys?" The old man pointed with a thumb to the crates that comprised his view of the Bolshoi. In the pre-dawn light, the Count could just make out a whirl of activity above them. "Are those bees?"
"Indeed they are."
"What are they doing here?"
"Making honey."
"Honey?"
The old man cackled again. "Making honey is what a bee does. Here."
Leaning forward, the old man held out a roof tile on which there were 2 slices of black bread slathered with honey. The Count accepted one and took a bite. The first thing that struck him was actually the black bread, for when was the last time he had even eaten it? If he asked outright, he would have been embarrassed to admit. Tasting of dark rye and darker molasses, it was a perfect complement to a cup of coffee. And the honey? What an extraordinary contrast it provided. If the bread was somehow earthen, brown and brooding, the honey was sunlit, golden and gay. But there was another dimension to it, an elusive yet familiar element, a grace note hidden beneath or behind or within the sensation of sweetness. What is that flavor? The Count asked, almost to himself. The lilacs, the old man replied. Without turning, he pointed with his thumb back in the direction of the Alexander Gardens. Of course, thought the Count, that was it precisely. How could he have missed it? Why, there was a time when he knew the lilacs of Alexander Gardens better than any man in Moscow. When the trees were in season, he could spend whole afternoons in happy repose under the white and purple blossoms. How extraordinary, the Count said, with an appreciative shake of the head. It is, and isn't, said the old man. When the lilacs are in bloom, the bees will buzz to the Alexander Gardens, and the honey will taste like the lilacs. But a week or so, they'll be buzzing to the garden ring, and then you'll be tasting the cherry trees. The garden ring? How far will they go? Some say a bee will cross the ocean for a flower, answered the old man with a smile, though I've never known one to do so. The Count shook his head, took another bite, and accepted a second cup of coffee. As a boy, I spent a good deal of time in Nizhny Novgorod, he recalled for the second time that day. Where the apple blossoms fall like snow, the old man said with a smile. I was raised there myself. My father was the caretaker on the Chernik estate. I know it well, exclaimed the Count. What a beautiful part of the world. So, as the summer sun began to rise, the fire began to die, and the bees began to circle overhead, the two men spoke of days from their childhoods, when the wagon wheels rattled in the road, and the dragonflies skimmed the grass, and the apple trees blossomed for as far as the eye could see. New chapter, excuse me, called Addendum, page 129. At the very moment that the Count heard the door to suite 208 clicking shut, Anna Urbanova was, in fact, falling asleep, but she did not sleep soundly. When the actress first dismissed the Count, having rolled onto her side with a languid sigh, she watched with cool pleasure as he gathered his clothes and drew the curtains. She even took some satisfaction when he paused to pick up her blouse and hang it in the closet. But at some point during the night, this image of the Count picking up her blouse began to trouble her sleep. On the train back to St. Petersburg, she found herself muttering about it, and by the time she returned home, it positively infuriated her. In the week that followed, if she had the slightest break in her demanding schedule, the image rushed forth, and her famous alabaster cheeks grew red with rage. Who does he think he is, this Count Rostov? Pulling out chairs and whistling at dogs, putting on airs and looking down noses is more like it. But by what right? Who gave him permission to pick up a blouse and hang it on its hanger? If I drop my blouse on the floor, what of it? It's my clothing, and I can treat it as I please. Or so she would find herself reasoning to no one in particular. One night, returning from a party, the very thought of the Count's precious little gesture was so infuriating that when she undressed, she not only threw her red silk gown on the floor, she instructed her staff that it was not to be touched. Each night that followed, she dumped another outfit on the floor. Dresses and blouses of velvet and silk from London and Paris, the more expensive, the better. Dumped here on the bathroom floor and there by the dustbin, in a word, wherever it suited her. After 2 weeks, her boudoir began to look like an Arabian tent with fabrics of every color underfoot. Olga, the 6-year-old Georgian who had met the Count at the door of Suite 208 and who had faithfully served as the actress's dresser since 1920, initially eyed her mistress's behavior with seasoned indifference. But one night when Anna had dropped a blue backless dress on top of a white silk gown, Olga observed matter-of-factly, "My dear, you are acting like a child. If you do not pick up your clothes, I shall have no choice but to give you a spanking." Anna Urbanova turned as red as a jar of jam. "Pick up my clothes?" she shouted. "You want me to pick up my clothes?
Then I shall pick them up. Gathering up 20 outfits in her arms, she marched to the open window and cast them into the street below. With the greatest satisfaction, the actress watched as they fluttered and coasted to the ground. When she wheeled about to confront her dresser in triumph, Ogle coolly observed how entertained the neighbors would be by this evidence of the famous actress's petulance. Then she turned and left the room, switching off the lights and climbing into bed, Anna sputtered like a candle. What do I care what the neighbors will say of my petulance? What do I care what St. Petersburg will say, or all of Russia? But at 2 in the morning, having tossed and turned, Anna Urbanova tiptoed down the grand staircase, slipped out into the street, and gathered up her garments one by one. A new chapter. It is now 1924. A new year. Titled Anonymity. Page 131. Dreams of invisibility are as old as folklore. By means of some talisman or potion, or with the help of the gods themselves, the corporal presence of the hero is rendered insubstantial, and for the duration of the spell, he may wander among his fellow men unseen. The advantages of having such a power can be rattled off for you by any child of 10, whether slipping past dragons, eavesdropping, or on intriguers, and sneaking into treasuries, or plucking a pie from the pantry, knocking the cap off a constable, and lighting the schoolmaster's coattails on fire. Suffice it to say that 1,000 tales have been told in acknowledgement of invisibility's bounty. But the tale that has less often been told is the one in which the spell of invisibility is cast upon the unknowing hero in the form of a curse. Having lived his life in the heat of battle, at the crux of conversation, and in the 20th row with its privileged view of the ladies in the loges, that is, in the very thick of things, suddenly he finds himself invisible to friend and foe alike, and the spell that had been cast over the Count by Anna Urbanova in 1923 was of this very sort. My apologies for the sound of the pipes here. Hope it's not too disruptive. Anyway, continuing page 131 in the middle of it. On that fateful night, when the Count had dined with the enchantress in her suite, she presumably had the power to render him invisible on the spot. Instead, to toy with his peace of mind, she had cast her spell to manifest itself over the course of a year, bit by bit. In the weeks that followed, the Count suddenly noticed that he was disappearing from view for a few minutes at a time. He could be dining in the piazza when a couple would approach his table with the clear intention of taking it as their own, or he could be standing near the front desk when a harried guest would nearly knock him off his feet. By winter, those prone to greet him with a wave or a smile often failed to see him until he was 10 feet away. And now, a year later, when he crossed the lobby, it often took a full minute for his closest friends to notice that he was standing right in front of them. "Oh," said Vasily, returning the telephone receiver to its cradle. "Excuse me, Count Rostov, I didn't see you there. How can I be of service?" The Count gave the concierge's desk a delicate tap. "You wouldn't happen to know where Nina is?" In asking Vasily for Nina's whereabouts, the Count was not making a passing inquiry of the first chap he happened to meet, for Vasily had an uncanny awareness of where people were at any given time. "She is in the card room, I believe." "Ah," said the Count with a knowing smile. Turning about, he walked down the hall to the card room and quietly opened the door, assuming he would find 4 middle-aged ladies exchanging cookies and profanities over tricks of whist. As an attentive spirit held her breath in a cupboard, instead, he found the object of his search sitting at the card table alone, with 2 stacks of paper in front of her and a pencil in hand. She appeared the very model of scholastic enthusiasm. The pencil was moving so brightly, it looked like an honor guard parading across the page with its head held high, then pivoting at the margin to make the quick march back. "Greetings, my friend." "Hello, your countship," Nina replied without looking up from her work. "Would you like to join me for an excursion before dinner? I was thinking of visiting the switchboard." "I'm afraid I can't at the moment."
The Count claimed the seat opposite Nina as she put a completed sheet of paper on one stack and took a fresh sheet of paper from the other. Out of habit, he picked up the deck of cards that sat on the corner of the table and shuffled it twice. Would you like to see a trick?
Some other time, perhaps.
Kneading the deck, the Count replaced it on the table. Then he picked up the topmost sheet from the stack of completed papers. In carefully aligned columns, he found all of the cardinal numbers from 1,100 to 1,199. In accordance with some unknown system, 13 of the numbers had been circled in red. Needless to say, the Count was intrigued. What are we up to here?
Mathematics.
I see you are addressing the subject with vigor.
Professor Lisitsky says that one must wrestle with mathematics the way one wrestles with a bear.
Is that so? And which species of bear are we wrestling with today? More polar than panda, I suspect.
Nina looked up at the Count with her glint-extinguishing stare.
The Count cleared his throat and adopted a more serious tone. I take it the project involves some subset of integers.
Do you know what a prime number is?
As in 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13?
Exactly, said Nina. Those whole numbers that are indivisible by any number other than one
and itself. Given the dramatic manner with which she had said indivisible, one might have imagined Nina was speaking of the impregnability of a fortress.
At any rate, she said, I'm making a list of them all.
Them all?
It is a Sisyphean task, she admitted, though with an enthusiasm that prompted one to wonder if she had complete command of the term's etymology. She pointed to the already inscribed pages on the table. The list of prime numbers begins with 2, 3, and 5, as you say, but prime numbers grow increasingly rare the larger they become. So it is one thing to land upon a 7 or 11, but to land upon a 1009 is another thing altogether. Can you imagine identifying a prime number in the hundreds of thousands, in the millions? Nina looked off in the distance as she could see the largest and most impregnable of all the numbers situated on its rocky promontory, where for thousands of years it had withstood the onslaughts of fire-breathing dragons and barbarian hordes. Then she resumed her work. The Count took another look at the sheet in his hands with a heightened sense of respect. After all, an educated man should admire any course of study, no matter how arcane, if it be pursued with curiosity and devotion. Here, he said in the tone of one chipping in, this number is not prime. Nina looked up with an expression of disbelief. Which number?
He laid the paper in front of them and tapped a figure circled in red.
1,173. How do you know it's not prime?
If a number's individual digits sum to a number that is divisible by 3, then it, too, is divisible by 3.
Confronted with this extraordinary fact, Nina replied, Mon Dieu.
Then she leaned back in her chair and appraised the Count in a manner acknowledging that she may have underestimated him. Now, when a man has been underestimated by a friend, he has some cause for taking offense, since it is our friends who should overestimate our capacities. They should have an exaggerated opinion for our moral fortitude, our aesthetic sensibilities, and our intellectual scope. Why, they should practically imagine us leaping through a window in the nick of time with the words of Shakespeare in one hand and a pistol in the other. But in this particular instance, the Count had to admit he had little grounds for taking offense, because for the life of him, he could not imagine from what dark corner of his adolescent mind this extraordinary fact had materialized.
Well, said Nina, pointing to the stack of completed papers in front of the Count. You'd better hand me those.
Leaving Nina to her work, the Count consoled himself that he was to meet Mishka for dinner in 15 minutes, and besides, he had yet to read the daily papers. So, returning to the lobby, he picked up a copy of Pravda from the coffee table and made himself comfortable in the chair between the potted palms. After scanning the headlines, the Count delved into an article on a Moscow manufacturing plant that was exceeding its quotas. He then read a sketch on various improvements in Russian village life. When he shifted his attention to a report on the grateful school children of Kazan, he couldn't help but remark on the repetitiveness of the new journalistic style. Not only do the Bolsheviks seem to dwell on the same sort of subject matter day to day, they celebrated such a narrow set of views with such a limited vocabulary that one inevitably felt as if one had read it all before. It wasn't until the fifth article that the Count realized he had read it all before, for this was yesterday's paper. With a grunt, he tossed it back on the table and looked at the clock behind the front desk, which indicated that Mishko was now 15 minutes late. By then, the measure of 15 minutes is entirely different for a man in step than for a man with nothing to do. If for the Count, the prior 12 months could be characterized politely as uneventful, the same could not be said for Mishka. The Count's old friend had left the 1923 RAPP Congress with a commission to edit and annotate a multi-volume anthology of the Russian short story. That alone would have provided him with a reasonable excuse for being late, but there was a second development in Mishka's life that earned him even more latitude with his appointments. As a boy, the Count had a well-deserved reputation for marksmanship. He had been known to hit the schoolhouse bell with a rock while standing behind the bushes on the other side of the yard. He had been known to sink a kopeck into an inkwell from across the classroom, and with an arrow and bow, he could pierce an orange at 50 paces. But he had never hit a tighter mark for a greater distance than when he noted his friend's interest in Katerina from Kiev. In the months after the 1923 Congress, her beauty became so indisputable, her heart so tender, her demeanor so kind, that Mishka had no choice but to barricade himself behind a stack of books at the old Imperial Library in St. Petersburg. "She's a firefly, Sasha, a pinwheel," or so said Mishka, with the wistful amazement of one who has been given only a moment to admire a wonder of the world. But then one autumn afternoon, she appeared in his alcove in need of a confidant. Behind his volumes, they whispered for an hour, and when the library sounded its closing bell, they took their conversation out onto the Nevsky Prospect and wandered all the way to Tikhvin Cemetery, where on a spot overlooking the Neva River, this pinwheel, this wonder of the world, had suddenly taken his hand. "Ah, Count Rostov," exclaimed Arkady in passing, "there you are. I believe I have a message for you." Returning to the front desk, Arkady quickly rifled through some notes. "Here." The message, which had been taken down by the whole hotel's receptionist, conveyed Mishka's apologies and explained that as Katerina was under the weather, he was returning to St. Petersburg earlier than planned. Taking a moment to mask his disappointment, the Count looked up from the note to thank Arkady, but the desk captain had already turned his attention to another guest. "Good evening, Count Rostov." Andrei took a quick look in the book. "A party of two tonight, isn't it?" "I'm afraid it's going to be a party of one, Andrei." "Nonetheless, it is our pleasure to have you. Your table should be ready in just a few minutes." With the recent recognition of the USSR by Germany, England, and Italy, a wait of a few minutes had become increasingly common at the Boyarsky, but such was the price of being welcomed back into the Sisterhood of Nations and the Brotherhood of Trade. As the Count stepped aside with a man... As the Count stepped aside, a man with a pointed beard came marching down the hallway, with a protege in tow. Though the Count had only seen him once or twice before, the Count could tell that he was the commissar of something or other, for he walked with urgency, talked with urgency, and even came to a stop with urgency. "Good evening, Comrade Soslovsky," said Andrei with a welcoming smile. "Yes," pronounced Soslovsky, as if he'd just been asked where he wanted to be seated immediately. With a nod of understanding, Andrei signaled a waiter, handed him two menus, and directed him to lead the gentleman to table 14. Geometrically speaking, the Boyarsky was a square at the center of which was a towering arrangement of flora. Today, forsythia branches in bloom, around which were 20 tables of various sizes. If one considered the tables in respect to the cardinal points of a compass, then, at Andrew's instruction, the waiter was now leading the commissar to his and his protege to the table for two at the northeast corner, right next to where a jowly-faced Belarusian was dining. Andrew, my friend, the maitre d' looked up from his book. Isn't he the chap who had an exchange of words with that bulldog of a fellow a few days ago? An exchange of words was something of a polite diminution of the facts. For on the afternoon in question, when this Soslovsky had wondered aloud to his luncheon companions why the Belarusians seemed particularly slow to embrace the ideas of Lenin, the bulldog, who had been sitting at a neighboring table, had cast his napkin on his plate and demanded to know the meaning of this. With a disregard as pointed as his beard, Soslovsky suggested there were three reasons, and he began to tick them off. First, there is the relative laziness of the population, a trait for which the Belarusians are known the world over. Second, there is their infatuation with the West, which presumably stems from their long history of intermarriage with the Poles. But third, and above all else, alas, the restaurant was never to hear the above all else, for the bulldog, who had knocked back his chair at the word intermarriage, now hoisted Soslovsky off his seat. In the scramble that ensued, it took three waiters to separate the various hands from the various lapels, and two busboys to sweep the kitchen maréchal from the floor. Chicken maréchal from the floor. Recalling the scene in a flash, Andrew looked back toward the table 13, where the bulldog in question was currently seated with a woman of such similar aspect that any seasoned logician would conclude she was his wife. Spinning on his heels, Andrew rounded the forsythia blossoms, headed off Soslovsky and his protege, and led them back to table 3, a lovely spot at the south-southeast, which could comfortably accommodate a party of four. "Merci beaucoup," said Andrew upon his return. "De rien," replied the Count. Let me take a quick break for some water here. Sometimes I just trip up a little bit. Page 138. How far are we going to get? Okay, I have hopes of where we're going to get to. Page 138, at the top, after the dot dot dots at the top. In replying, "It is nothing," to Andrew, the Count was not simply resorting to a Gallic figure of speech. In point of fact, the Count deserved as much thanks for his little intervention as a swallow deserves for its trill. For since the age of 15, Alexander Rostov had been a master of seating tables. Whenever he was home for the holidays, his grandmother would inevitably call him into the library where she liked to knit by the fireplace in a solitary chair. "Come in, my boy, and sit with me a moment." "Certainly, grandmother," replied the Count, balancing himself on the edge of the fire grate. "How can I be of assistance?" "The prelate is coming for dinner on Friday night, as are the Duchess Oblinsky, Count Kerrigan, and the Minsky Politovs." Here she would let her voice trail off without further explanation, but no further explanation was needed. The Countess was of a mind that dinner should provide one with respite from life's trials and tribulations. Thus she could not countenance discussions of religion, politics, or personal sorrows at her table. Further complicating matters, the prelate was deaf in his left ear, partial to Latin epigrams, and prone to stare at Delacotage whenever he drank a glass of wine, while the Duchess Oblensky, who was particularly caustic in summer, frowned upon pithy sayings and could not abide discussions of the arts. And the Kerrigans, their great-grandfather had been called a Bonapartist by Prince Minsky-Polatov in 1811, and they had not exchanged a word with a Minsky-Polatov since. "How many will be in attendance?" asked the Count. 40. "The usual assembly? More or less. The Osipovs? Yes, but Pierre is in Moscow." "Ah," said the Count with the smile of the chess champion who has been confronted with a new gambit. The Nizhny Novgorod province had 100 prominent families, which over the course of 2 centuries intermarried and divorced, borrowed and lent, accepted and regretted, offended, defended, and dueled, while championing an array of conflicting positions that varied by generation, gender, and house. And at the center of this maelstrom was the Countess Rostov's dining room, with its 2 tables for 20 standing side by side. "Not to worry, grand-mère," assured the Count. "A solution is close at hand." Out in the garden, as the Count closed his eyes to begin moving through the individual permutations one by one, his sister enjoyed making light of his task. "Why do you furrow your brow so, Sasha? However the table is arranged, we will always have such delightful conversations when we dine." "However the table is arranged," the Count would exclaim. "Delightful conversations! I'll have you know, dear sister, that careless seating has torn asunder the best of marriages and led to the collapse of the longest-standing détente. In fact, if Paris had not been seated next to Helen when he dined in the court of Menelaus, there never would have been a Trojan War." A charming rejoinder, no doubt, reflected the Count from across the years. But where were the Oblenskys and the Minsky-Polatovs now? With Hector and Achilles. "Your table is ready, Count Rostov." "Ah, thank you, Andrei." 2 minutes later, the Count was comfortably seated at his table with a glass of champagne, a small gesture of thanks from Andrei for his timely intervention. Taking a sip, the Count reviewed the menu in reverse order, as was his habit, having learned from experience that giving consideration to appetizers before entrees can only lead to regrets. And here was a perfect example, for the very last dish on the menu was the evening's sole necessity, osso buco, a dish that was best preceded by a light and lively appetizer. Closing his menu, the Count surveyed the restaurant. Undeniably, he had felt a little low when he had climbed the stairs to the Boyarsky, but here he was, with a glass of champagne in hand, osso buco in the offing, and the satisfaction that he had been of service to a friend. Perhaps fates, who of all their children loved reversal the most, were set upon lifting his spirits. "Do you have any questions?" Thus came an inquiry from behind the Count's back. Without hesitation, the Count began to reply that he was ready to order, but as he turned in his chair, he was struck dumb to discover that it was the bishop who was leaning over his shoulder in the white jacket of the Boyarsky. Now, admittedly, with the recent return of international guests to the hotel, the Boyarsky had become a little understaffed, so the Count could well appreciate why Andrei had decided to bolster his crew. But of all the waiters at the piazza, of all the waiters in the world, why would he choose this one? The bishop seemed to be following the Count's train of thought, for his smile became especially smug. "Yes," he seemed to be saying, "here I am, in your famed Boyarsky, one of the chosen few, who pass with impunity through the doors of Chef Zukovsky's kitchen." "Perhaps you need more time," the bishop suggested, his pencil poised over his pad. For an instant, the Count considered sending him on his way and asking for a new table, but the Rostovs had always prided themselves on admitting when their behavior lacked charity. "No, my good man," replied the Count, "I am ready to place my order. I will have the fennel and orange salad to start, and the osso buco to follow." "Of course," said the bishop. "And how will you be having the osso buco?" The Count almost betrayed by his amazement. "How will I be having it? Does he expect me to dictate the temperature of a piece of stewed meat?" "As the chef prepares it," replied the Count magnanimously. "Of course. And will you be having wine?" Absolutely. A bottle of the San Lorenzo Barolo 1912. Will you be having the red or the white? A Barolo, the Count explained as helpfully as he could, is a full-bodied red from northern Italy. As such, it is the perfect accompaniment to the Orso Buco of Milan. So then you will be having the red. The Count studied the bishop for a moment. The fellow gives no evidence of being deaf, he reflected, and his accent would suggest that Russian is his native tongue, so surely by now he should have been on his way to the kitchen. But as the Countess Rostov liked to remark, if patience wasn't so easily tested, then it would hardly be a virtue. Yes, said the Count, after counting to five, the Barolo is a red. The bishop continued to stand there with his pencil poised over his pad. I apologize, he said unapologetically, if I am not being clear, but for your selection of a wine tonight, there are only two options, white and red. The two men stared at each other. Perhaps you can ask Andrew to stop by for a moment. Of course, said the bishop, backing away with an ecclesiastical bow. The Count drummed the tabletop with his fingers. Of course, he says. Of course, of course, of course. Of course what? Of course, you are there and I'm here. Of course you have said something and I have replied. Of course a man's time on earth is finite and may come to an end at any moment. Is something the matter, Count Rostov? Ah, Andrei, it's about your new man. I'm quite familiar with him from his work downstairs, and in that venue, I suppose a certain lack of experience is to be tolerated, or even expected, but here at the Boyarsky. The Count opened both hands to gesture toward the hallowed rooms, and then looked to the maitre d' with an expectation of understanding. No one knew Andrei in the slightest would ever describe his demeanor as gay. He was not some barker at a carnival, or an impresario of light entertainments. His position as the maitre d' of the Boyarsky called for judiciousness, tact, and decorum. So the Count was quite accustomed to Andrei having a solemn expression, but in all his years of dining at the Boyarsky, he had never seen Andrei appear this solemn. He was promoted at the instruction of Mr. Halecki, explained the maitre d' quietly. But why? I'm not certain. I presume he has a friend. A friend? Uncharacteristically, Andrei shrugged. A friend with influence. Someone within the table servers union, perhaps, or at the commissariat of labor, or in the upper echelons of the party. These days, who can tell? My sympathies, said the Count. Andrei bowed in gratitude. Well, you certainly can't be held accountable if they foist the fellow upon you. And I will adjust my expectations accordingly. But before you go, can you do me a small service? For some incomprehensible reason, he will not let me order my wine. I was just hoping to get a bottle of the San Lorenzo Barolo to accompany the Orso Buco. If such a thing could be imagined, Andrew's expression grew even more solemn. Perhaps you should come with me. Having followed Andrei across the dining room, through the kitchen, and down a long, winding stair, the Count found himself in a place that even Nina had never been, the wine cellar of the Metropole. With its archways of brick and its cool, dark climate, the Metropole's wine cellar recalled the somber beauty of a catacomb. Only, instead of sarcophagi bearing the likeness of saints, receding into the far reaches of the chamber were rows of racks laden with bottles of wine. Here was assembled a staggering collection of Cabernets and Chardonnays, Rieslings and Syrahs, Ports and Madeiras. A century of vintages from across the continent of Europe. All told, there were almost 10,000 cases, more than 100,000 bottles, and every one of them without a label. What has happened? Gasped the Count. Andrei nodded in grim acknowledgement. A complaint was filed with Comrade Teodorov, the commissar of food, claiming that the existence of our wine list runs counter to the ideals of the revolution. That is a monument to the privilege of the nobility, the effetness to the intelligentsia, and fetidness of the intelligentsia and the predatory pricing of speculators. That's preposterous! For the second time in an hour, the unshrugging Andrew shrugged. A meeting was held, a vote was taken, an order was handed down. Henceforth, the Boyarsky shall sell only red and white wine with every bottle at a single price. With a hand that was never meant to serve such a purpose, Andrew gestured to the corner, where beside five barrels, a confusion of labels lay on the floor. It took ten men, 10 days to complete the task, he said sadly. But who on earth would file such a complaint? I am not certain, though I have been told it may have been originated with your friend. My friend? Your waiter from downstairs. The Count looked at Andrew in amazement. But then a memory presented itself, a memory of a Christmas past when the Count had leaned from his chair to correct a certain waiter's recommendation of a Rioja to accompany a Latvian stew. How smugly the Count had observed at the time there was no substitute for experience. Well, thought the Count, here is your substitute. With Andrew a few paces behind him, the Count began walking the cellar's center aisle, much as a commander and his lieutenant might walk through a field hospital in the aftermath of battle. Near the end of the aisle, the Count turned down one of the rows. With a quick accounting of columns and shelves, the Count determined that in this row alone, there were over 1,000 bottles. 1,000 bottles virtually identical in shape and weight. Picking up one at random, he reflected how perfectly the curve of the glass fit in the palm of the hand, how perfectly its volume weighed upon the arm. But inside this dark green glass, was what exactly? A Chardonnay to complement a Camembert? A Sauvignon Blanc to go with some Cher? Whichever wine was within, it was decidedly not identical to its neighbors. On the contrary, the contents of the bottle in his hand was the product of a history as unique and complex as that of a nation or a man. In its color, aroma, and taste, it would certainly express the idiosyncratic geology and prevailing climate of its home terrain. But in addition, it would express all the natural phenomena of its vintage. In a sip, it would evoke the timing of that winter's thaw, the extent of that summer's rain, the prevailing winds, and the frequency of clouds. Yes, a bottle of wine was the ultimate distillation of time and place, a poetic expression of individuality itself. Yet here it was, cast back into the sea of anonymity, that realm of averages and unknowns. And suddenly the Count had his own moment of lucidity. Just as Mishka had come to understand the present as the natural byproduct of the past, and could see with perfect clarity how it would shape the future, the Count now understood his place in the passage of time. As we age, we are bound to find comfort from the notion that it takes generations for a way of life to fade. We are familiar with the songs of our grandparents, favored, after all, even though we never dance to them ourselves. At festive holidays, the recipes we pull from the drawer are routinely decades old, and in some cases even written in the hand of a relative long since dead. And the objects in our homes, the oriental coffee tables and well-worn desks that have been handed down from generation to generation, despite being out of fashion, not only do they add beauty to our daily lives, they lend material credibility to our presumption that the passing of an era will be glacial. But under certain circumstances, the Count finally acknowledged this process can occur in the comparative blink of an eye. Popular upheaval, political turmoil, industrial progress, any combination of these can cause the evolution of a society to leapfrog generations, sweeping aside aspects of the past that might otherwise have lingered for decades. And this must be especially so when those with newfound power are men who distrust any form of hesitation or nuance, and who prize self-assurance above all. For years now, with a bit of a smile, the Count had remarked that this or that was behind him, like his days of poetry or travel or romance. But in so doing, he had never really believed it. In his heart of hearts, he had imagined that, even if unattended to, these aspects of life were lingering somewhere, on the periphery, waiting to be recalled. But looking at the bottle in his hand, the Count was struck by the realization that, in fact, it was all behind him, because the Bolsheviks, who were so intent upon recasting the future from a mold of their own making, would not rest until every last vestige of his Russia had been uprooted, shattered, or erased. Returning the bottle to its slot, the Count went to join Andrei at the foot of the stairs. But as he passed among the shelves, it occurred to him that it was almost all behind him, for he had one last duty to attend to. Just a moment, Andrei. Starting at the end of the cellar, the Count began weaving back and forth through the rows, systematically scanning the racks from top to bottom, until Andrei must have thought he had lost his reason. But in the sixth row, he came to a stop. Reaching down to a shelf at the height of his knee, the Count carefully took a bottle from among the thousands. Holding it up with a wistful smile, he ran his thumb over the insignia of the two crossed keys that was embossed on the glass. On the 22nd of June 1926, the 10th anniversary of Helena's death, Count Alexander Ilyich Rostov would drink to his sister's memory. Then he would shed this mortal coil once and for all. And I think we'll stop there. That's the end of that chapter. And next time we're starting with a new time period, so I think it's a good place to stop. All right. Thanks for joining me today. Hope you're enjoying it, and I'll see you next time. Bye.